You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the role third-party candidates play in presidential elections as a couple more hopefuls announce their intention to run. First, a new report says President Trump is unhappy with FBI Director Charles Wray and would love to replace him. However, according to Axios, that's unlikely to happen. That's unlikely to happen before the November elections. The report follows the release of documents by a federal judge last week that show the FBI debated over how to proceed with the investigation of Michael Flynn. He's President Trump's former national security advisor. Flynn twice pleaded guilty to lying to the agency about his communications with Russia's ambassador to the U.S. before Trump's inauguration. The newly released notes that got a lot of attention say top agency officials questioned if their goal in interviewing Flynn was, quote, to get him to lie so we can prosecute him or get him fired. Trump says that proves Flynn was set up.
If you look at those notes from yesterday, that was total exoneration. These were dirty, filthy cops at the top of the FBI, and you know the names better than I do, and they were dishonest people. Now we have to see what's going to happen.
Supporters of the FBI's actions, though, say the records show the agency was being very thoughtful and careful about how to proceed. Adam Goldman is a reporter at the New York Times who covers the FBI and national security. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's step back from the details here. Can you tell us what these documents are and why they're being released now?
Well, these documents, the most inflammatory ones are of the head of counterintelligence, Bill Priesteps. I believe they're from his notebooks that were uncovered as part of a Justice Department review of the Flynn case, and they were handed over recently to Flynn's lawyers.
And talk about some of the other FBI players involved with these documents. What other names what are coming up in the release of these?
Well, you know, Deputy Director Andy McCabe, you know, a longtime target of President Trump. He was involved in these discussions along with Peter Strzok, who interviewed General Flynn at the White House. And that he was involved with these notorious text messages with his lover at the time, Lisa Page. So he's been mentioned in context with these notes and these meetings that took place before the FBI decided to interview Flynn.
And what, now people are reading these in different ways. At a basic level, what do these notes tell us?
Well, some of the stuff, there are a few things that have been put out. There have been some text messages put out about, you know, interview notes. I mean, there's one way to look at these notes and what Priestep wrote were, he, you know, the FBI at that moment was closing its investigation of Mike Flynn. They hadn't found anything, you know, that merited keeping it open longer. And then the IC, the intelligence community, discovers that there are these intercepts, right, of the Russian ambassador talking to Flynn. And Flynn had lied to the vice president about his conversations with the Russian ambassador. And that was very concerning to the FBI. So Bill Priestep, the head of counterintelligence, are in this meeting and he's writing down, well, what are our goals here, right? And, you know, I'm not here to defend what the FBI did, but, you know, typically the FBI looks at threats and they say, how do we mitigate them, right? We can get them, we can catch them on 1001, we can get them fired from the job. Let's say there was a leaker in the intelligence community, they couldn't prove it, but they wanted to lose a security clearance. So, you know, on the one hand, you might view these notes through the prism of the FBI mitigating this particular threat, right? Because they knew he had already lied to Flynn. Right. He already locked into this story. I mean, sorry, Flynn had already lied to the vice president. So what was he going to do with them? Was he going to tell the truth? Right. It wasn't clear. So on the other hand, you know, Flynn supporters see this as a witch hunt. The president sees it as a witch hunt. And this is all evidence of wrongdoing by the FBI. They set him up to lie. The big problem with this information, A, it's not clear. It's exculpatory because Flynn did lie to the FBI, and he lied repeatedly, and he's admitted that twice. The second big issue is the judge has already ruled on this issue. The defense lawyers for Flynn have already brought up this idea that he was ambushed and trapped into lying. The judge has already ruled, he ruled in late 19, that this was not the case, that in fact there was no evidence that this happened. And by the way, the Supreme Court rules, it's not even clear if it matters. Like, the FBI is a course of business. You know, the thought of a terrorism attack or, you know, a sting, you know, they might give somebody an AK-47. They might get somebody a missile launcher. They might get somebody a car bomb. So, you know, these are called stings. And, you know, lots of defense lawyers say this is entrapment. And, you know, generally it's almost unheard of that these type of entrapment defenses work.
Talking to Adam Goldman from the New York Times about papers that came out from the investigation related to former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. So, Adam, as you said, a judge had already ruled on this, but it sounds like Flynn's legal team is hoping to bring this, or they're bringing it back before the judge and hoping for a different outcome. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what they're hoping. They're hoping that this is exculpatory material, and the judge will see this in a new light, and it's not exactly clear they will. Look, the lawyers have judges ruled repeatedly on things, right? They've also accused, you know, the FBI of altering interview notes, right? And this shows they were out to get, you know, they were out to create a lie. But the judge has the actual notes from Flynn's interview with the FBI. So this is, you know, he's ruled on this too, that since he has the actual notes, that these later interview documents, you know, they all line up. So this has been a consistent and truculent attack on the prosecutors and the FBI who brought this case. And, you know, Flynn's supporters see this as, you know, as evidence of wrongdoing. You know, the issue here, and the judge, and what the judge has to take into account here is, you know, Flynn now says, after pleading guilty twice, I've been there for both pleadings. And on the second one, the judge carefully walked him through the plea, right? It's almost as if he knew that this might be an issue down the road. You know, he asked Flynn, did you know it was a crime to lie to the FBI before this interview? And he said, yes, you know, I did know it was a crime to lie to the FBI. So he walked him all through these things. It's not clear what the judge is going to do. Will he let Flynn withdraw his plea, you know, his plea? I'm not so sure. You know, it's a very, very serious thing. You get in front of a judge and you plead guilty, knowingly plead guilty.
So we heard the president there saying this shows that there were dirty, filthy cops at the top of the FBI. And there's been talk about whether the president might ultimately pardon Michael Flynn. What's the latest we're hearing on whether that's something the president's considering?
I have to say, it's sort of a mystery. If the president believes this is so egregious, then why hasn't he pardoned Flynn? Why hasn't he done this? Only the president can answer this. You know, so it's hard to understand the president's motivations when he's been out there repeatedly saying that this is bad. And let's not forget, Flynn, he pleaded guilty as part of his plea agreement. He pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI. But as part of that agreement, he also acknowledged that he violated other laws, foreign lobbying laws, right, with his dealings with Turkey, which is very serious. They didn't charge him with that, but he acknowledged it. It was a statement, an admission of truth there. So I don't know what the president's going to do. If he pardons Flynn, does he pardon everybody else who was charged and then prosecuted by, you know, the special counsel's team? It's unclear, but it's a great question. And you know, only Trump knows what's in the president's head. So,
well, we'll see what the future holds. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
Adam Goldman is a reporter with the New York Times who covers the FBI and national security. We talked to him about the release of FBI documents relating to the investigation of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Coming up, Dr. Seuss meets Dr. Dre. We'll meet a Wisconsin performer who's putting a groove behind some grovulous poems. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there are two doctors in the house. We'll talk to an artist who mashed up children's books and hip-hop. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story just in time for Star Wars Day, May the 4th.
Star Wars is one of the most beloved movie franchises in the world, and a big part of those movies are the droids who fight alongside the Rebel Alliance and Resistance. There's BB-8, who first appeared in 2015's The Force Awakens.
Where do you come from?
Really?
Classified, really.
And of course, C-3PO and R2-D2.
R2-D2, it is you.
A few dozen Wisconsinites have taken their love of Star Wars to another level, by creating their own versions of droids, just like the ones featured in the movies.
This is an R2-D2. Our club builds these and all the different robots from Star Wars and other movies.
That's Mike Messino of Madison. He built this R2 and brought it to the most recent Madison Mini Maker Faire.
It was just kind of a robotics project. Yeah, I wanted to do something from a movie. It'd be fun. You know, it's just a remote-controlled robot. It's within millimeters of the one that's in the movie. It's almost exactly the same. So,
Messino and other fans from around the world share blueprints and building tips online. People who join official builders clubs can even buy parts and often cheer each other on.
Oh, yeah, big time. You know, it's all kinds of, a lot of trial and error went into getting them working.
Messino grew up watching the Star Wars movies and says he's always been a big fan. He takes his R2-D2 to charity events and children's hospitals, plus Comic-Cons and other events like the Maker Faire. And thank goodness he does, because you should see how people light up around these droids, including myself.
So when R2-D2 first approached me, when we turned around a corner, for some reason I got really emotional. It's like meeting a celebrity who's just always been in your life, but it's weird because, like, it's a robot.
Exactly. I mean, that's why we do it, right? So that people can experience that.
I wasn't the only person getting excited. Kids had a lot of questions for the event's other celebrity droid, BB-8.
Can you, like, move him around?
Yeah.
How fast can he go?
Phil Carper of Waukesha maneuvers his BB-8 with an Xbox controller, smoothly rolling the homemade round droid throughout the room.
He is made out of mostly 3D printed plastic and like injection molded plastic for the little skeleton underneath it.
Building this droid was a lot of trial and error over the course of 2 years, with Carper and his wife initially using fiberglass. Ultimately, he also turned to a supportive online community to help figure out how to build BB-8.
Hey guys, I'm having this weird issue where his head won't stop wobbling, and this guy will be like, oh, here's what I did, and blah, 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 and just, really, everybody just bounces all their ideas off each other, and we wouldn't be able to do this, like, one guy would have a very hard time figuring it out by himself.
It's really impressive watching BB-8 in action. Its dome-like head almost levitates above its spherical body thanks to a combination of magnets, weights, and motors on the inside. Like many people in the droid builders clubs, Carper was raised on Star Wars.
You can thank my mom for that.
He says the movies will always be a huge part of his family life.
Because I have a one-year-old, and I usually have him here with me at all this stuff, and he loves to run around with all the kids that come up and gather. He thinks it's like his pet. You know, before Luke was born, I was working on this thing, so.
That's right. His son's name is Luke.
Precious. Does he know the power of his name yet?
No, not yet. I'm waiting until he's old enough to understand Star Wars before I show him the movies, because if anybody spoils the Empire thing, I'm going to lose my mind. I want to see his reaction.
Phil Carper, father of Luke, may the Force be with you. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, if you're like about 3.5 million people, you may have already seen this video on YouTube. If you haven't, give a listen.
Fox socks, box knocks, knocks in box and fox in socks, knocks on fox and socks in box, socks on knocks and knocks in box, fox and socks on box on knocks.
That's Milwaukee-based multimedia artist Wes Tank. Let's get right to him to explain what we just listened to there. Wes, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
All right, it seems like a match made in heaven. Tell us what led you to put that together and what we just heard there.
Oh, well, you know, one day I just found a copy of One Fish, Two Fish on the ground before a show, and I happened to have a Dr. Dre beat on my phone, and just spur of the moment decided to put the two together in rap form. And, it was kind of, it worked out, and then I tried it again at a different show, and realized, oh, a lot of these books and a lot of these beats kind of go well together.
Yeah, so. Did it take a lot of fitting and forcing to make the natural cadence of Dr. Seuss fit with the beats of Dr. Dre, or did it just kind of come naturally?
It was so natural, and every time I try one, you know, some go better with others, but that's the thing, is it just works, and it just sort of clicks immediately, and I can tell when the vibe of the song and the vibe of the book are working together, so it's pretty just instinctual and organic.
Now, is this the only combo you've tried, Dr. Seuss and Dr. Dre, or have you tried, I don't know, Mo Willems and Vanilla Ice or anything? Or is this just the perfect combo and you're sticking with it?
Oh, I'm definitely trying a lot of other things. I've been experimenting quite a bit. I've been doing a little William Shakespeare, MF Doom, a little Pharrell and Lewis Carroll. I'm just trying all sorts of different things right now because of how much people love the Dr. Seuss and Dr. Dre. I also have a lot of my own producer friends who I've worked with for a lot of years that I'm going to be working with more in the future.
Shakespeare, iambic pentameter, does that match up with a straight 4/4 beat pretty well?
It's challenging. It's challenging. The more syllables you have, the more challenging it is, and you have to find the right rhythm and the right pacing. So definitely not easy.
We're talking to Milwaukee-based multimedia artist Wes Tank about his very popular YouTube videos where he mashes up Dr. Seuss words with the beats of Dr. Dre. Let's give another listen to one now, a bit from the Lorax.
The instant I finished, I heard a gazump. I looked and saw something pop out of the stump of the tree I chopped down. It was a sort of man. Describe him, that's hard. I don't know if I can. He was shortish and oldish and brownish and mossy. He spoke with a voice that was sharpish and bossy. Mister, he said with a sawdusty sneeze. I am the Lorax. I speak for the trees. I speak for the trees. For the trees have no tongues. And I'm...
Wes, tell us about getting into character here, because we hear the two different main characters from the Lorax.
Yeah. I like to look at the pictures and imagine what they sound like. So I look at the Lorax and what he's all about, and I just, for some reason, Tom Waits comes to mind, and I have like a kind of a long lasting Tom Waits impression I've been working on for a long time, and I gave that to the Lorax. So and then the other one is just kind of, he's the Onceler, and he talks about how he speaks with a sawdusty sneeze, and he's kind of like, he's got a little bit of more of a up here type of voice. And you want him to kind of go back and forth. So, you know, the one character might have like a higher pitched voice and the other one has a lower pitched voice. And so you want those like diametrically opposed forces to kind of work and get in people's heads a little bit, you know, so they separate them a little bit.
You started with this zany idea, and now these things have gone nuts online. Can you talk about the response you've gotten here?
Oh, it's been lovely. I mean, I feel so, my heart is warmed so much by the way people have responded. Parents, you know, have told me, you know, there's a lot of parents that are homeschooling right now, and that they said this is just a godsend for homeschooling, because it can be hard to get kids to want to pay attention to learning activities right now and when they're not in the school environment. So this kind of, you know, just, it's a little spoonful of sugar to make the medicine go down. And, you know, just, that's why we do story wraps. It's just kind of like, it's just a way to get literature into kids' hands and get kids reading, you know.
You mentioned how this felt in your heart. Did it feel almost as though your heart had grown three sizes that day?
Absolutely, probably even more, maybe 3 million.
That makes me wonder, is the Grinch in the cards? I didn't see it on your site, at least not yet, I don't think.
Oh, well, you know, the really cool thing about the Dr. Seuss universe is that there's one for, you know, a lot of different occasions, and that's a little more down the Christmas line. And so we're looking at the long game with this project and plan to be doing this for a while. So look forward to that a little closer to Christmas time, I would say.
Now, I would think the target audience here would be kids, but I got to say, I was looking through some of your YouTube comments there. There were some grown-ups pointing out, yeah, I'm a, 50-year-old dude, and I'm watching somebody rap Dr. Seuss videos, and I'm glad about it. This is appealing to people of all ages, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, I think people that grew up in the 90s grew up with the Dr. Dre and kind of gangster rap and things like that. And so there's that nostalgia. And then, like, everybody grew up with Dr. Seuss. So there's parents want to share that with their kids, and they love to share Dr. Dre with them, but in a child-friendly manner, I guess. And I think nostalgia is, like, contagious.
And as we wrap up, Wes, you've got the videos. There's some production in them, too. It's a lot of fun. When we can have live shows again, do you see maybe a full-on Dr. Seuss live performance in your future?
Oh, absolutely. I do a show at Bookworm Gardens every year. That's in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. It's like a storybook botanical garden. And so I'm already booked to play this year, and we don't know exactly how that's going to go. Hopefully we're able to have shows again by that point. It's in October, though. It's usually at the end of October. So, but yeah, absolutely. I'd love to play more shows. I'd love to play schools and theaters and whatever wants to have me play.
Wes, thanks a lot for sharing that with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That's Wes Tank, a multimedia artist based in Milwaukee. We talked to him today about his now very viral video series mashing up Dr. Seuss books over Dr. Dre beats. Coming up, independent representative Justin Amash has announced he's forming a committee for a possible presidential run. He's not the only potential third-party candidate looking ahead to November. We'll talk about third parties and their impact on American politics. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, get crafty with ideas and inspiration for craft projects around the house and homemade decorations for your household. That's tomorrow at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, we're just shy of 6 months until people head to the polls to vote in the 2020 general election. President Trump is the incumbent Republican nominee, and former Vice President Joe Biden is the presumptive Democratic nominee. But no election would be complete without a third-party candidate joining the race.
Who's the best qualified person up here on the stage to create jobs? Make your decision and vote on November the 3rd. To American people, I'm doing this because I love you. That's it.
Don't waste your vote on politics as usual. Vote for Ross Perot.
Campaign ads filled with half-truths. $10 million. Promises to special interest groups. Over $10 billion. Finding out the truth? Priceless. There are some things money can't buy. Without Ralph Nader in the presidential debates, the truth will come in last.
Make healthcare and college free, create a welcoming path to citizenship, and end systemic racism. It's time to reject the lesser evil and fight for the greater good, like our lives depend on it, because they do. I'm Dr. Jill Stein.
I heard from many that they didn't want to waste their vote. Wasting your vote is voting for somebody that you don't believe in. I'm running for President of the United States. I am the third party.
You just heard from businessman Ross Perot, attorney and activist Ralph Nader, Dr. Jill Stein, and former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson, all of whom ran as third-party candidates over the last few decades. Now, in 2020, there are a few candidates starting to throw their hats into the ring for president, including independent Michigan Representative Justin Amash. He's looking at a run as a libertarian. Our next guest joins us to talk about the role that third parties play in American politics and their impact on elections, especially presidential elections. Laura M. Brown is an associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Laura, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to be with you.
Well, Laura, every time we have a significant third-party candidate in a race, there's arguments before the campaign about which major party candidate they're going to help or hurt more. There's arguments often for decades afterward about what happened. How do we, in general, evaluate the impact of a third-party candidate running for president?
Well, so third parties do have an impact, and the biggest impact they have is at the idea side. And by that, I mean what they usually do is raise issues that are not being addressed by either major political party. If they start to gain traction, the political parties that are the two central ones will usually look to those issues and see if they can't kind of co-opt them for themselves, make them their own, and start arguing those issues to the electorate to attract some of those third-party voters who were drifting in that direction. And so usually what happens is over time, the third party, which may have initially swelled, kind of recedes as the major political parties take over those issues and start changing their directions.
There are a lot of barriers to entry for third parties, especially in a presidential race. You got to get on the ballot, in effect, one state at a time. The Electoral College makes it hard. Can you talk about just how high a hurdle it is if you want to be a third party candidate and think you're going to have a chance to win this thing?
Well, let's start with the basics, which is plurality elections. In the United States, we say that the person with the most votes is the person who wins, and that is the case at the popular vote level. The Electoral College then says the person with the most electoral votes, so long as it's a majority, wins. So these are high hurdles. And what happens in these systems is that everyone who is a voter says to themselves, I want to vote for somebody who's got a legitimate chance. And typically, third parties are only going to earn somewhere, you know, between 1 to 5% of the vote. So Americans say to themselves, I don't want to waste my vote. And that's part of this kind of vicious cycle of how high the hurdle is, just even at the argument level. And you could hear that in the montage that you put together, where so many of those third party candidates were trying to say, you're not wasting your vote by voting for me.
We're talking about third-party presidential runs with Laura Brown from the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. We mentioned Justin Amash, a member of Congress, former Republican. He's gone independent, now looking at a run as a Libertarian. Here he is speaking on CNN saying candidates like him represent more of America than the two big parties. Here's a listen.
Most Americans are delightful people, are polite people, want to work with each other, respect each other. And these two factions that really control our political system are destroying our system and making it impossible for the rest of us to frankly enjoy our lives. So I want to go there and represent these millions of people. And I think we are at that crossroads where this kind of change can happen. Things are not settled the way they were maybe 30, 40 years ago. We have a lot of uncertainty right now, and there's an opening for a Libertarian Party to become a major party in this country.
So that idea that there's this large unrepresented mass of Americans discontented with the two-party system, creating an opening for a third party, in this case, the Libertarian Party. It's not the first time we've heard that argument, though, is it, Laura?
No, and this is where it's so interesting, because it is true that about 4 in 10 Americans say that they are independent, that they really don't have an affiliation with either major political party. But the problem is when you probe those independents, they don't agree with each other. And in fact, for the most part, they sort of split down the middle in terms of leaning issue-wise toward one party or the other. So what usually happens is that there are a kind of subset, series of issues that a group of independents might all agree on. But on most things that the parties really do take opposite stances on, that in fact splits the independents as well and doesn't leave much room for the libertarian or really any other third party.
When we look at countries with multi-party systems, often with proportional representation, it seems like the chance for any given individual to find a match on a lot of issues gets a lot higher with more parties to choose from. Here in the U.S., if you're, I don't know, pro-choice, but are opposed to immigration levels as they are, want them lower, well, one party represents one party, the other party represents, and you got to flip a coin. Are we in some ways more poorly represented because we have to compromise to some extent with one of two parties?
Well, it's interesting because what you would hear a lot of political scientists say is that the two major political parties right now are sort of more ideologically coherent than they have been in the past. So if you go back a good 50 years in our history, you actually saw conservative Democrats and progressive Democrats existing within the same Democratic Party. That was also true on the Republican side of the aisle. And most of the political science research would say that people were more poorly represented then because they didn't necessarily know what their party was going to stand for. In other words, right now, party positions are very clear. I think this is also why not all Americans feel comfortable with either major political party, and we have seen independents grow in terms of identification. But it is a difficult thing to try to translate people's interests with what the party's stances are. And I do think there are definitely some problems with our current system as it sits.
We're talking to Laura Brown right now, associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. She's with us to talk about the role third-party candidates play in presidential elections. We have Congressional Representative Justin Amash talking about a libertarian campaign. There are already libertarians running as well. Former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura trying to get on the Green Party ticket, maybe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about third-party candidates? Have you ever supported and or voted for a third-party or independent candidate for president? What is it that drew you to that candidate? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about third-party presidential candidates as a couple of hopefuls announce that they're looking into running. Former Republican, now independent Congressman Justin Amash has announced a libertarian campaign. Former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura has expressed interest, at least, in running for the Green Party nomination. Laura Brown is with us, associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see more third-party candidates running? Do you feel underrepresented and or underwhelmed by the Democrats and the Republicans in this particular election? Do you want another alternative? Have you voted third-party in the past? Or do you encourage people to not support third-party candidates, making the wasting your vote argument? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Ryan is with us in Superior. Ryan, hi.
Hi. Yes, I appreciate you guys taking my call. When I initially at the last election that swept Trump into office, I voted in the primaries for Bernie Sanders because I was supporting someone who I felt represented the values of what I'd like to see in our nation. And when he lost to President Clinton, I found myself in a situation where I had to choose between, you know, what two politicians that I found just were not going to do anything that I wanted to see. And in the end, I went with a third-party candidate. And some people were mad at me about that, but I really don't regret my decisions on that because I've always been taught that, you know, ever since I was in grade school, that what you do with when you vote in your elections is that you stick by what you feel you'd like to see represented in our nation.
Ryan, thanks a lot for the call. And Laura, Ryan, not alone, I think, in 2016.
Not at all. And one of the things that I think is important to realize is that, you know, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were two of the most highly unfavorable presidential candidates we have had in polling history. So one of the realities was that a lot of people believed that the outcome of the election was something of a foregone conclusion. Many people believed that Hillary Clinton was going to win the election. And as a result, many people said, it's important for me to vote for a third party to try to send a message to the two major parties that they need to do better. And the truth of the matter is 6% of the total electorate voted for a third party or an independent candidate, and that's very high. It's also what kept Hillary Clinton into only getting a plurality. She earned 48% of the popular vote. So while it was more than Donald Trump, it was that 48% that also caused part of the problem with the inversion in the Electoral College.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Wyatt now with us in Sparta. Wyatt, hello.
Hi, I hope you can hear me okay.
Go for it.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that even though I like the idea of parties like the Green Party, Libertarian Party, I just don't think they'd ever have, like, the power to, you know, like, enough votes behind them just the way the system's set up. You know, I just don't even, I mean, I don't even remember the last time I've seen one on a debate stage, you know? So.
Wyatt, thanks a lot for the call. Laura, is Wyatt probably predicting the near future, at least accurately? We're not likely to see a huge emergence of a third party?
Well, that's correct. I mean, I do think in 2020, there is a very different type of dynamic. This is an incumbent reelection campaign, and what that means is that most Americans are saying to themselves, do they want President Trump to continue for four more years, or do they not? And they're not really casting about for an open seat or a bigger choice about who would they like to see in office, which is what happened in 2016. But let me just touch on one other thing. There has been an incredibly important third-party candidate, and his name was Ross Perot. He did change much of the politics throughout the 1990s, partly because of the more than 10 million individual voters that he has been said to have essentially engaged or activated, got excited about politics. He ended up getting a total of about 19 million votes, and that did end up changing the way the two major parties behaved during the 1990s because they were looking to woo the Perot voter.
Thanks a lot for that call. We've had some questions on our Facebook page about the option of ranked choice voting. I've seen that happening at the local level, people advocating for it at the national level. The idea that you could say, yeah, number one, the third party candidate, if they're out of the picture, then my vote goes to someone else. A tall order to get it into place, but is that something that could make a difference?
Well, what it does is it really allows people to express, as the caller said, the first caller, your sincere preference, right? Your sincere preference is the person you would most like to be in office and not worry about whether or not that vote was going to matter, because you could express that preference and then were that person not to even earn enough votes to kind of continue on, then that vote would go to your second choice or your third, depending on how many candidates were on the ballot.
Well, Laura, we'll leave it there and watch as maybe more candidates get into the race. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Certainly. Thanks for having me on.
We've been talking to Laura M. Brown, Associate Professor and Director of the Graduate School of Political Management at The George Washington University in Washington, D.C. She joined us today for a look at the role third parties play in American politics. You can keep sharing your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page as we get closer to the 2020 general election. Earlier early on in the coronavirus pandemic, there were fears about a shortage of ventilators to treat COVID-19 patients. States, including Wisconsin, even developed guidelines for who should receive the equipment if supplies ran short. But as Bram Sable-Smith reports, doctors' thinking on that topic is evolving.
COVID-19 has many symptoms: fever, cough, and loss of smell and taste. But the symptom that really concerns UW Health's Dr. Jeff Potthoff is shortness of breath.
If you're going to get in trouble with COVID-19, it's going to be based on your inability to breathe.
For some COVID patients, the disease can mimic something called acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. It's a life-threatening condition where fluid builds up in the lungs. Mechanical ventilators are one way to treat that. And as the epicenter of COVID-19 spread from China to Europe to the U.S., Potthoff says ventilators were used often. Not only did COVID seem to resemble ARDS, but ventilators required less protective gear for healthcare workers than some alternatives, and waiting can be risky.
It's a little bit harder to take all the precautions you need to take to make sure your staff stay safe.
But Potthoff says there remains an important question about the practice. How effective is it for COVID-19?
I think that kind of evidence is kind of in question now. I don't think we know the answer to that.
Dr. Paul Casey of Bellin Health in Green Bay was a little more blunt on WPR's The Morning Show.
Essentially, we now think putting somebody on a ventilator is almost a death sentence.
Mechanical ventilators are highly invasive. They require a tube to be inserted through a patient's mouth, and air is forced into their lungs. There are established protocols for treating ARDS with ventilators, but in an editorial examining 150 COVID patients in Italy, physician Luciano Gattinoni argues those protocols could be wrong or even dangerous for many COVID patients.
If you use an ARDS protocol, you kill the patient. And this is what's happened, I'm afraid, in New York and so on.
During a global pandemic like this, the experience and research of physicians around the world, like Gattinoni, spreads quickly. And Bellin Health physician John Cazuta says they are well aware of the warnings about overusing ventilators.
If you over-distend a balloon with air, what happens? It pops. And if you go ahead and over-distend the lungs, you may get this injury called barotrauma.
Essentially, that's lung damage from pressure changes. Cazuta says the goal for the vast majority of COVID patients at Bellin is to keep them off of ventilators entirely. There are less invasive practices, like turning patients on their stomachs and delivering oxygen through the nose or with a mask.
These are more effective in trying to keep people who are in the earlier to moderate stages of disease so they don't require a ventilator.
Even so, some COVID patients with the most severe symptoms still need ventilators, and the state is still tracking the supply. Currently, the number available is over 3 times the number in use. A big reason is the state finding some success flattening the curve. Availability could change if there were a large spike in cases. ICU nurse Kat Zanecki at St. Francis Hospital in Milwaukee says there could be another factor keeping ventilator use down in Wisconsin. The public is aware of the illness and seeking treatment.
They're not staying home sick. They're coming in to say, hey, I think I'm sick. You know, the earlier you catch anything, the better.
Zanecki says whether a COVID patient will benefit more from a ventilator or a different treatment should be decided on a case-by-case basis. And right now in Wisconsin, doctors have the time and equipment to do that. Bram Sable-Smith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That story comes to us from a partnership between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Watch. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, bad air quality may make COVID-19 worse for some people. At the same time, shutdowns may be improving air quality. We'll look at the complicated relationship between air pollution and our health. From the Black Death to Ebola and beyond, the author of a new book shares the history of epidemics, how they shaped human society, and how cultures and societies have reacted to them successfully or otherwise. And a lot of people are making time for their hobbies now, either setting up some new ones or digging out an old one. We're going to dig into the history of the hobby, and you can share yours. You can get us started right now over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us what a hobby you've either gotten into or made more time for. Share pictures if that's relevant. Again, tell us about your hobby over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, Brown County saw a surge in positive COVID-19 tests last week. Kate welcomes the mayor of Green Bay for a look at that news and the community reaction. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll hear from Wisconsin Public Radio Director Mike Crane with the latest on WPR programming and operations, including upcoming COVID-19 specials and tomorrow's event, Giving Tuesday. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.